Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the U.S. economy. You've heard the numbers. Last month, inflation hit a four-decade high. Meanwhile, unemployment remains at historic lows. More than three-quarters of the largest U.S. companies have reported higher revenue than before COVID-19. Yet supply chain problems mean people won't have enough of the basics to make holiday treats this year. All this has Americans feeling jittery about their personal economic future as well as that of the country. Now, the Fed has moved into action, promising to hike interest rates to combat higher prices hitting Americans' pocketbooks. Greg Ipp is chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal. I spoke with him about how to make sense of what's happening and what the Biden administration can do to ease economic worries. Greg Ipp, it's so good to see you.
It's great to be back talking to you, Diane.
Thank you. We've all been hearing so much about inflation and what's going on, not only in certain areas of the country, but all over the U.S. Tell us what sectors where prices are surging are the worst.
Well, pretty much everything is going up in price, but there are certainly things that are going up more. These are, by and large, what we would call durable goods, things that you buy that are meant to last several years. The most prominent example is used cars and new cars. And there are the stories is that there's a shortage of semiconductors, which turn out to be really important for cars. So you have a limited supply of cars and a lot of people who want to buy them. And so their prices are up a lot. But it turns out that all sorts of goods are in short supply, whether it's furniture or even materials for building homes and buildings. Those are in short supply, partly because of demand, partly because the supply chains are tangled up. You know, all those container ships off of the coast of California that aren't able to unload. In recent months, though, we've also seen inflation creeping into other areas. For example, meals away from home, that is to say restaurant meals, those are getting more expensive, partly because the workers that typically produce those meals are harder to come by and they can now earn higher wages. And finally, one thing where we're starting to see signs of inflation rear the heads is in housing. Home prices are up 14% this year. And once the statistics people run that through their models, they find that that is finding its way into more expensive shelter costs.
So Democrats argue that supply chain bottlenecks are the problem. Republicans say it's too much government spending. Is it either or both or neither?
Am I allowed to say all of the above, Diane? You know, it's a very unusual inflation we're dealing with right now. We haven't seen really anything like it in the last 50 or 60 years. What do I mean by that? Well, you could say that, you know, there's the old funny George Bernard Shaw line, is that to get an economist, you just have to teach a parrot to say supply and demand over and over again. And that's what we have here. It's not just that demand is high, and it's not just that supply is constrained. It's the two of those things happening together. We were just talking about cars, for example. We know that the supply of cars is constrained. But it's also the case that people, interest rates are low. So people want to go and buy cars. Plus, you know, a lot of people need them for commuting. And so that elevated demand kind of collides with this constrained supply. And so you get the two things operating together. I think the question this raises is, well, what does it take to fix the inflation problem? If the White House and the Federal Reserve are right, then probably in like 3 to 6 months, a lot of the supply chain problems will have worked their way out and that problem will have gone away. But in the meantime, it is still the case that demand is quite high. People do have a lot of money still sitting in their bank accounts left over from their stimulus checks. The stock market is up a lot, so people feel wealthy. So it's likely the case that even once we work our way through some of these supply problems, we'll still have inflationary pressures there owing to the very strong spending that's going on.
So as you and I are speaking Friday morning, the stock market on the heels of the Fed making its announcement that it would begin to raise interest rates, the stock market is down some 500 points this morning. So is it that old rule that higher interest rates mean lower stock market prices, or is there something different going on here?
Well, it's funny. As you were alluding to, the Federal Reserve on Wednesday announced that it was worried enough about inflation that it was going to move up its plans to raise interest rates. It did say that it thinks that in 2022, it will raise interest rates probably three times, a total of 0.75 percentage point. Back in March, they didn't think they would raise them at all next year. They didn't think they would have to raise rates until 2024. So the Fed is clearly telling us that they're worried enough about inflation that they need to cool things off by raising the cost of borrowing. And historically, that has meant a slower economy. Higher interest rates are also bad for stocks because it means that, well, you can now get a better return on a certificate of deposit. So why keep your money in the stock market? So maybe that is one thing that's going on that explains why stocks are having a bit of a rough period right now. However, it's not as simple as saying that interest rates go up, stocks go down. And that's because what the Fed is trying to do here is sort of thread a needle, raise interest rates just enough that the excess of spending cools off and inflation comes back to, you know, between 2 and 3% instead of staying up around 6% where it is now, but that they don't overdo it. They don't cause interest rates to go up so much that demand just collapses and we end up in a recession. So I would say that, you know, looking past over the last week or two, the stock market has known for some time that the Fed was going to start raising interest rates. And so you've seen it kind of gyrate up and down. Right now, I would say it's betting that we're going to get that good soft landing scenario. The Fed has to raise interest rates to cool things off just enough to maintain economic growth and inflation coming down. Whether we actually get that soft landing scenario, that's a very difficult thing to judge right now.
How is all this different from, say, 40 years ago?
If you go back to the like early 1980s when I first got into this business, it seemed that inflation was on everybody's mind. It was typically in the 5 to 10% area. When Gallup would go out and ask people, what's the biggest problem facing the country? You would get 30 or 40, sometimes 50% of people saying inflation is the number one problem facing the country. And then Paul Volcker became chairman of the Federal Reserve. He said enough is enough. He pushed the economy into a very, very deep recession with interest rates going up to around 20%. And it basically broke the back of inflation. It fell to around 4% and then 3% and 2%. And now for, you know, over 30 years, until this year, it had basically hovered around that 2% area. And, you know, Diane, there are like millions and millions of people in this country who've never known anything other than that low inflation. And in some sense, what we've learned from history is that just the habit of believing that inflation will always be low causes us to behave in certain ways. We sort of like hold, we don't respond immediately when the price goes up. We hold out because we think it's going to come down. If an employer is deciding what to pay his employees, he doesn't decide to pay them more because he thinks inflation is going to last because his experience tells him it will not last. Economists call this inflation expectations. When people expect inflation to be low, they behave in a way that it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy and it actually stays low. What I think we're worried about right now, Diane, is that the longer we are here with inflation as high as it is, 5 or 6% levels that we haven't seen since the late 1980s, the more those expectations start to become unmoored and people begin behaving like high inflation is here to stay. You've seen, for example, a couple of strikes at the Kellogg company, at the John Deere company that makes agricultural equipment. A big issue in those strikes is unions want protection from rising inflation. And when the company grants them that extra protection, the company is implicitly saying, well, we think we can raise our prices to cover the cost of those higher wage agreements. When you see that happening, workers asking for and getting higher wages and companies responding by raising their prices, you worry about a self-sustaining wage price spiral. I don't think we're there yet. We're only talking about a handful of instances, but it's certainly the case that the risk of something like that is higher today than it has been for many years.
What about the stimulus program and the monies that individuals have been receiving on a monthly basis? That's about to stop. But how has that affected inflation?
Well, this is, as you know, a very controversial subject. About a year ago, Larry Summers, who used to be the Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, was an advisor to Barack Obama, a stalwart of democratic economics and therefore no enemy of this president. He began warning that the very generous stimulus that President Biden was at the time enacting, it was called the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan, was going to basically do just as you were suggesting, which is lead to too much spending and overheat the economy. Was he right? Yes and no. I would say the following. It is the case that people simply didn't need all that extra money because they were not being held back by lack of money. They were being held back because they were worried about the virus. And so they took that extra money and they spent it in a situation where, as we were talking about earlier, the economy wasn't fully reopened. It wasn't able to provide all the restaurant meals that people suddenly wanted because they didn't have the staff and so forth. So that was one of the causes that went on. That said, whether that stimulus can explain all the inflation right now, I doubt that. And there's another thing to keep in mind. The stimulus is basically over. People are not going to get another round of stimulus checks. All the enhanced unemployment insurance has now expired. It is the case that people still have a lot of cash in their bank accounts, and so they do have the ability to spend. Plus, stocks and housing prices are up a lot, so that makes people feel wealthy. So we'll still get some pressure on spending, and that might find its way into inflation for some months to come. But I don't think stimulus from the federal government is going to be the big story for the coming year. I think really the big story is the fact that as people have been getting jobs at a very rapid rate, they now have a lot of wage income with which to spend.
So wage income has been pushed up to a certain extent because employees feel they have more power now. Employers have been on the lookout for workers and they've declined because they want higher wages. Now, how could higher wages contribute to inflation?
There's a very complex set of forces at work right now in the labor market. We, in spite of how strong the economy is and how low the unemployment rate is, it's a little bit deceptive because we have roughly 4 to 5 million people missing from the labor force.
Right.
In other words, if the labor force had kept growing at the same rate before the pandemic, we would have millions of more people out there either working or looking for work. So where did these people go? Well, we know that about half of them retired and they're just not coming back earlier. We know that some people are just worried about the virus. They don't want to get sick. And they say, you know what? The paycheck's not important enough for me to risk my health or my family's health. And now, unfortunately, with this Omicron variant becoming a serious challenge out there, that source of hesitancy is likely going to continue. For a while, it was the case that people with small children simply weren't able to work because the kids were home from school and had to be looked after. But with schools fully back in to in-person teaching, I think that's becoming less of an issue. But then there's a final thing, which is what we have come to call the Great Resignation. I think a lot of people at lower paid jobs have essentially said, the bargain is just not worth it. Going to work very hard, on my feet all day, doing this work, especially nowadays with customers who might be like sick or who are getting in a very cranky mood because we ask them to wear a mask, that's not worth $12 an hour any longer. And besides, Amazon just opened a fulfillment center down the road, and I can go there and I can get $16 an hour. So all these factors, I think, mean that the worker who used to be willing to take a job for $12 an hour is now quite logically holding out for $14 or $15 or $16 an hour. And employers are saying, well, if we want to meet our customer demand, we have to pay that salary. And so that's actually a good thing, Diane. I think it's a good thing that a lot of these people who for so many years had no leverage at all and had to take really difficult jobs at low pay, they now have a choice. I think that's possibly one of the very good things to come out of this.
So what kinds of choices does this leave the people who are making the decisions about where the economy should go and how they should handle those decisions?
Well, there's basically two folks that have a say in this. One is President Biden and one is Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. Let's talk about Biden for a moment. So, to the extent that maybe he put a bit too much money in the economy with the stimulus a year ago, it's too late to do anything about that. He's not going to you know, come out and say, give us the money
yeah,
back.
All right.
He just can't do that. And a lot of people, I think, have unfairly said that his Build Back Better plan is going to add to inflationary pressures. It's really not a big part of the story. I mean, that is money that will roll out over 10 years. It's just not a big part of the story. There might be little things he can do at the margin. So, for example, one of the issues we have is there's a shortage of truckers. So he's looking at ways to accelerate the training of young people as truck drivers. I think there might be exploration of speeding up the issuance of commercial truck driver licenses. I've even heard talk that maybe in some cases, they will lower the age at which a person is allowed to drive a truck. As you've probably heard, there are a lot of efforts underway to try and, for example, expand the areas around some of our ports where some of these containers can be deposited to try and loosen up the blockages that are occurring there. And the president also released some oil from the strategic reserve to try and take the pressure off oil prices. And in fact, we have seen some relief, not a lot, but we have some relief there. So those things all will help a little bit at the margin. But if the problem that we have fundamentally is there's too much demand and not enough supply, this is a job for the Federal Reserve. That's what the Fed was created for, was to make sure that the amount of money does not get ahead of the amount of goods and services in the economy. Inflation is their number one duty. And that is more or less what Jay Powell, as we call the Fed chairman, told us in the last week. We are on the case. We thought inflation would be transitory. It's turning out that transitory is taking a lot longer than we thought. We may need to act soon to slow things down. So ultimately, while the president can do a little bit of stuff around the margin, this is fundamentally an issue for the Fed to decide.
How much faith do you think the American people have in the Fed?
I think that even if they don't think about it this way, they actually do fundamentally believe that the Fed will get it right. And the reason I say that is that we can look at a variety of surveys where we ask people what they think inflation will be. They think it'll be high in the coming year, 4 or 5%. But when we ask them, what about, 5 years from now? They think it's going to be closer to where it's been in the past, somewhere between 2 and 3%. That's encouraging, because it tells you that those habits built up over 30 years when inflation was low have not yet gone away. People are not yet concluding that this is Weimar Germany or, the 1970s over again. They do not think that for whatever reason we'll be back into 5 to 10% wage price spiral land. But the caveat there, Diane, is that the Fed can't just talk about how it cares about inflation. It's got to act.
Yes.
It's got to mean it, which is mean that words that are not backed up by action will lose the trust of the American people.
So how soon would you expect the Fed to begin nudging that interest rate?
So the Fed has a fairly complicated timetable here. For the last year or so, they've been not just holding interest rates close to zero, but they've been in the market buying bonds. And when they buy bonds, that tends to push down long-term interest rates. What the Fed has just told us is that they plan to very quickly wind up that bond buying program by March. And they have more or less said that they will not raise interest rates until the bond buying program is over. Short answer, they could start raising interest rates as soon as March. That said, the Fed has not given up on the assumption that a lot of these price pressures will go away on their own.
Uh-huh.
So they don't want to rush into it. They want to actually give the whole process time to work its way out. And I will say there's a few encouraging signs. For example, we've just got news this week that industrial production has gone up a lot. So that means that some of those shortages that we talked about in the car sector might be easing. Home builders are building more houses. Maybe they've managed to overcome some of their shortages. It could be that if we give the Fed 3 to 6 months, they will discover that the inflation problem is not as bad and they won't have to raise interest rates quite as much as we're worried.
Now a quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Greg Ipp. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Greg Ipp. He's chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal. I ordered a piece of merchandise from a company in England, and I ordered it, a month and a half ago, and I got tracking on it, and it said it was at Charles de Gaulle Airport. And 3 weeks later, it was still at Charles de Gaulle Airport. So I got through to a human being who said to me, that's the way it is, and it's just going to take time. There are hundreds of thousands of pieces waiting to get out, but we don't have the wherewithal to get them out. Now, if other people are experiencing the same thing, that's going to be a pretty sad Christmas for an awful lot of people.
No, you're absolutely right. Now, when companies like Target and Walmart discuss the situation, they tell us that they've got all their Christmas ordering done, and they think that they'll be well stocked for the holidays. So, Diane, I really hope that the experience you're having with your French product turns out to be the exception and not the rule. But you know the way I think about this, it's like, you know how when you go to a show and then everybody tries to leave the parking lot at the same time, and as a result, nobody can get out. And so a parking system that works fine when people are coming and going one at a time and, you know, over the course of the day completely breaks down. Nobody can get out. Nobody can get in. You can't even back your car out of the space. And that's how I feel like the global supply chain looks right now. It's not just that there's a lot of demand for these products. It's that these little narrow pipes, you know, whether it's Charles de Gaulle Airport or whether the Port of Long Beach, Los Angeles, that are used to dealing with like 100 units per hour, they cannot deal with 105 units per hour, and everything backs up all around the world. But just as if you wait long enough after the show lets out, people will find their way out and the traffic jam will ease, that too will happen with our supply chains. But this is somewhat without historical precedent, Diane, and it's impossible to say whether that's a four-week, four-month, or six-month process.
There's another issue that was talked about today on Morning Edition, namely that there are now more older people in this country than there are younger people. What's that going to mean for the economy at large, and what impact could that have on inflation?
Well, the aging of the population has been with us for a long time, and you might say that in the last year or two, it sort of caught up with us. I was talking earlier about where did these 4 million missing workers go. Well, roughly half of them retired because they were like close to retirement anyway, and they didn't want to take chances with their health, given that we know how dangerous COVID-19 is for people who are older and who might have pre-existing health conditions. And their 401ks had been doing quite well. And economists and demographers have been telling us for a long time that the aging of the workforce was going to start causing severe labor shortage problems. Well, that sort of like caught with us, didn't it, in the last year, in the sense that COVID-19 accelerated that whole process. And I think that's one of the things that's in the back of the mind of the Federal Reserve and some other people, that even once some of the short-term pressures on inflation ease, we have these long-term pressures. And it's not just the United States, by the way. Every country around the world is aging. You may have heard that in China, the population has actually started to like go down because the one-child policy for so many years meant they just did not have a large pool of young workers coming into the workforce. There is one thing we can do about that, though, and that's immigration. We could allow more people into this country, and we know that there still are a lot of people who live in younger, poorer countries that want to come to the United States. But we've been doing the opposite. Roughly for the last 4 or 5 years, we've actually been turning the screws tighter on immigration. I've seen an estimate from JP Morgan that we are 3 million people fewer in this country than if immigration had continued at its pre-2016 rate. And most of those 3 million people would have been at working age, right? So although it's not the case that that explains all or even most of the labor shortage now, it's certainly the case that the labor shortage is worse today because of those missing people. And by the way, look at some of the industries where those people are most important. One of them is long-term care, where roughly 17% of employees are foreign-born. So this is an industry that is already seeing like epic numbers of people quitting because the work is so stressful and dangerous. Plus, they're like stuck with the situation that, well, where are the future workers going to come from, given that we have historically relied so much on first and second generation immigrants? So this is something that President Biden and the Congress could actually deal with right now. It won't turn things around right away, but it would be a very positive, proactive step to deal with some of the contributors to long-term inflation pressures.
You're saying to allow, to loosen the reins on immigration would help a great deal.
It absolutely would. Now, of course, in this country, immigration is a deeply polarizing issue.
Right.
And when you see all these people lining up at the border trying to get in, you know, it certainly raises a lot of concerns in Congress. So one of the things we have to do in this country is draw a clear line between illegal or undocumented immigration and legal immigration. As a country, we can probably agree that we need a strong, you know, and well-enforced system of legal immigration so that people do not jump the queue by trying to come in and claim asylum when, in fact, they're probably economic migrants, but that we make it easier for them to come in through legal routes, that those people who are applying for visas at our consulates, who are coming here under seasonal work problems, that they have a realistic chance of coming here working legally under one of these programs. That, I think, is a solution. And it is within, I think, the capability of the Congress to fix this problem if the will is there.
You had a conversation last week, I think, with Cecilia Rouse, chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. What was her perspective on how big a risk inflation is to our economy and possible strategies to mitigate that risk?
Well, this much I am comfortable saying about the economists in the Biden administration, they are not trying to sugarcoat this. They are not at all disputing that we have an inflation problem here. From Cece Rouse from the Council of Economic Advisors to President Biden himself, they have been upfront and direct saying this is a problem and we know it's causing a lot of hardship. I asked Cece Rouse, how did you get it so wrong? You thought inflation would be 2.5%. And she said, we just did not realize how much difficulty the ports and our logistics systems would have dealing with this historic level of demand for durable goods. So they, like the Federal Reserve, are still hoping and expecting that, you know, in a few months' time, a lot of these problems will work themselves out. But in the meantime, the president has a supply chain task force, which is looking at things like how do we like expand the capacity for bringing containers in? How do we expand the number of commercial truck drivers and so forth? But I would like to add something else that Chair Rouse and I talked about, and that is the long-term consequences on the economy of what we've been through in the last year or two with respect to school closures and education. It's kind of like a distant issue now when we're here talking about inflation and bottlenecks and so forth. But one of the most serious consequences, I think, people realize is that there's essentially an entire generation of kids who missed out on a year of school. And the economic research on this, Diane, is unambiguous. That is deeply costly in terms of their prospects for eventually graduating from high school, going to college, and earning a good income. And I think and that won't have consequences for our labor force and our inflation this year. It will have consequences 5 to 10 to 15 years down the road. And we as a country have got to find a way both to minimize going forward those types of disruptions now that we know how costly they are, and find a way to get these kids back on track as quickly as possible. One of the things Cece Rouse said was that, well, we know that more teaching resources is necessary. And thankfully, that was one of the provisions of the American Rescue Plan almost a year ago, which was to provide schools and states with the resources necessary if they can find the teachers and the people to do the jobs. It might require more summer school, for example, to get the kids back on track. And that will, in its own indirect way, address long-term inflation issues by ensuring that we have a well-educated and productive workforce.
What about the Build Back Better bill? Where is that going? And is there any consensus among economists as to whether, if it's passed, it could have an effect on inflation rates?
Well, the plan isn't going anywhere fast right now.
right.
As most of the listeners to your show probably know, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia has been very, very reluctant to agree to what the rest of his party wants in this Build Back Better plan. He's concerned about the price tag. I think we're now down to around $1.75 trillion, although the number keeps moving around. And he say, well, we just, you know, spent like almost $2 trillion on the American Rescue Plan. We spent, you know, a big whack of money on the infrastructure plan. If we pour more money into this economy, that's just going to make the inflation problem that we have today worse. You know, I think that his concerns are a little bit overblown. For one thing, the Build Back Better plan, as designed, will also raise taxes. And so it's not like it's $1.75 trillion of borrowed money being dumped into the economy. Now, that said, a lot of those taxes won't arrive until the later part of the decade. So in the short run, he's absolutely right that there's more spending going into the economy than's being taken out by taxes. And so in the first few years, yes, the Build Back Better plan, as currently conceived, does add to the deficit, does add a sort of modest amount of stimulus to the economy, and therefore does make the inflation problem a little bit worse. He's right about that. But it doesn't make it a lot worse. We're talking like maybe a quarter of a percentage point. And that is a problem that the Federal Reserve is well equipped to deal with. The Fed can, you know, was very worried that we didn't have enough spending a year ago, and so it was encouraging more government stimulus. Now with the opposite problem, they're saying, look, if the government's going to put more stimulus in, we, the Fed, may have to raise rates, interest rates even more to make sure that the inflation problem is taken care of. What I'm saying here is that Joe Manchin shouldn't be directing his concerns to President Biden and his fellow Democrats. He should be directing them to the Fed and making sure that they will do whatever it takes, no matter what happens with respect to government spending, to make sure inflation is on track.
As a bit of a sidebar here, I wonder about the revelations in the Washington Post yesterday regarding Joe Manchin's income from his investments in coal, and the results of that revelation. Do you think that will affect his behavior at all in regard to what he's been saying about, well, we're spending too much money here and coal is being hurt in my state? And I just wonder, because this presented a very different view from what we have heard, but what many people have suspected about Joe Manchin and his income from coal.
You know, I'm only aware of a few of the like broad brush details of that, so I really can't speak to what that means for Joe Manchin. But I think I can make a few broad points. Look, Manchin has been like quite upfront about saying he is not a liberal. He simply doesn't believe in big government. He's been quite upfront about the fact that he represents a state where coal is very important. So whether, irrespective of what his personal holdings are, I can't believe that anybody would be surprised that Joe Manchin would resist measures to basically phase out coal faster. I just don't think that anything he's doing or saying should come as a surprise to anybody. And I think it's also reasonable to look at some of the substantive issues that Joe Manchin has raised. He points out that the $1.75 trillion price tag, or whatever the amount is a little bit deceptive, because there are many provisions in there, like the child tax credit, like the free pre-K, which phase out very quickly. And that's, you know, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it's a lot of these provisions, which Democrats hope to become permanent one day, in the bill phase out in just a few years for nothing other than cosmetic purposes to keep the apparent price tag down. And others, including Senator Manchin, point out that what Democrats would really like is for those programs to become permanent. And if one day they got their way, then the price tag would be quite large and quite a bit more than what the taxes are planned to actually raise this. And one of the ironies here, Diane, is that Democrats had come into, like, they now control all the levers of power in Washington, whether they will after next year's midterms is another question. They have all those levers, and yet despite their, you know, stated desire to raise taxes on the rich, can't seem to bring themselves to actually do that. And so the numbers are, you know, a little bit deceptive in the sense that, like, this isn't really a fully paid for plan. And the other point I think that was made, and I believe Senator Manchin and some others made this, is that instead of trying to do 10 to 20 things in this bill, pick two or things that are really important, fully fund them, and do them properly. And that is something that the rest of the party has chosen not to do, and instead choose this route of putting a whole bunch of items from their wish list into this plan, and then, in some sense, artificially reducing the price by sunsetting them after a few years. So I guess I think that until the rest of his party deals with the substance of his concerns in some way, it's not a great prospect that all these, you know, disagreements are going to go away.
So finally, Greg, how much do you believe that if the Fed does not get control of inflation by raising interest rates in 2022 and 2023, perhaps, that there is really quite a danger for Democrats in the upcoming elections?
Milton Friedman once said that the lags for monetary policy are long and variable. So what that basically means is it really doesn't matter what the Fed does right now. The results will not show up in time to make that much of a difference to the Democrats' fortunes in next November's midterm elections. There's a good scenario for Democrats here, which is that many of the short-term problems that are bottling up supply go away. That tangle line of ships off of the West Coast basically shrinks. You know, suddenly Charles de Gaulle manages to get your packages to you. And that the virus recedes enough that a lot of the people who don't want to go to work feel comfortable going back to work, and the labor shortage fixes itself. And that's not a crazy scenario, by the way. I would say that's actually probably what most economists think will happen. And that problematic and irksome as inflation is today, it'll be quite a bit less of a problem, I think, come the fall. You know, the less positive scenario is that that doesn't happen. Inflation is still 3 or 4%. And then I think there's two possibilities. One is that the Fed basically says, well, we're going to live with 3 or 4% inflation for a while and try and get used to that, which I don't think anybody will be happy about. The other is it gets really worried and says, look, we're going to have to raise interest rates a lot more than we thought. And it's going to have a little bit of that feeling of the early 1980s when Paul Volcker had to do the same thing and a recession was the result. Neither of those are, frankly, terribly appetizing scenarios. So I think everybody is kind of crossing their fingers and hoping that that sort of good scenario of a lot of these problems working themselves out is, in fact, the one that materializes.
And if you had to make a prediction now?
My prediction is that it'll be the good scenario. You know, we've already seen some positive news happen on the supply side front. We've actually, when we look at surveys of manufacturers, they tell us that the log jams are getting a little bit better. As we were talking about earlier, people will not have a new round of stimulus checks next year. A lot of people will find that their savings have run down enough that they kind of have to do go back to work. I'm sitting here hoping and praying and crossing my fingers that Omicron turns out not to be a devastating healthcare threat and will be in the rearview mirror, you know, sometime by the spring. And, you know, the one thing that gives me comfort, that seems to be the scenario that the financial markets are also betting on.
Greg, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. Great to talk to you again.
That was Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineers today are Adrian Danhauser and Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening. And a quick note, we're taking a break for the next 2 weeks. While we're away, we'll bring you some old favorites from my archive. So I wish you a happy and healthy holiday. I'm Diane Rehm.